tie and blue nylon jacket. Beyond him lay a wide tree-lined road and pavements of clean beige gravel. The large mansion houses were mostly embassies and their residences. Flags fluttered and brass plates gleamed. The sale price of even one of the staff apartments would probably clear my debts at the clinic, pay Kelly's education right through to doctorate level, and still leave enough to put a new roof over most of Norfolk. The gateman looked me up and down as if I was something one of the posh embassy dogs had left coiled on the curb. He didn't get up, just stuck his head out of the window.
Yes?
Number 3A, May. Pick up. I pointed to the now empty day sack on my back. I really hadn't planned to be a courier today, but it seemed the easiest thing to do. At least I looked the part. With the letters and my South London accent turned up a notch or two. He pointed up the road.
100 yards, up on the left. Don't park in front of the building. Put your machine over there.
He indicated to the opposite side of the road. I let in the clutch and waited for the steel bollards blocking my way to disappear into the road. The Israeli embassy loomed up on my left. A dark-skinned guard in plain clothes stood outside on the pavement. He must have been feeling quite cold, as his coat and suit jacket were unbuttoned. If anyone attacked the place, he had to be able to reach his weapon and gun them down before the uniformed British policeman on the opposite side of the road got a chance to step in and make a simple arrest instead. About 70 meters past them both, I parked in the line of cars opposite the apartment building. Walking across the road towards its grand gates, I started removing my gloves and unbuckling my helmet. Then I hit the bell and explained to a voice where I wanted to go. The side gate opened with a whir and a click, and I walked through and down the drive. The building was bigger than most of those around it and set back from the road. It was made of red brick and concrete and was decades younger than its neighbours, with manicured gardens on each side of the drive that led downhill to a turning circle with an ornate fountain at its centre. Pulling off the ski mask that kept the cold off my face, I walked through the main doors into a glittering dark marble and glass reception area. The concierge, another king sitting on his throne, seemed to view me the same way as his mate down the road.
Delivery, is it?
Nobody calls you sir when you're in bike leathers. It was time to play courier boy again.
Nah, pick up. P.P. Smith, mate.
He picked up the internal telephone and dialed, his voice changing into Mr. Nice Guy the moment he got a reply.
Hello, reception here. You have a courier for a collection. Do you want me to send him up?
Certainly. Goodbye.
The phone went down and he turned surly again, as he pointed to the lift.
Third floor, fourth door on the left.
As the lift doors closed behind me, I had a quick check round for closed-circuit cameras, then pulled out my USP. Checking chamber, I hit the button for the third floor. I never knew why I checked chamber so much. Maybe it just made me feel more in control. As the lift kicked in with a slight jerk and took me upwards, I folded the ski mask over the USP and placed it and my right hand in the helmet. If there was a drama, I could just drop the helmet and react. The lift slowed. Placing my thumb on the safety catch, I was ready. The door slid open with an upmarket ding, but I stood my ground for a few seconds, listening, helmet still in my left hand so I could draw with my right. The temperature changed as I stepped into the corridor and the doors closed behind me. It was hot, but the decor was cold. White walls, cream carpet, and very brightly lit. I followed the carpet, looking for the fourth door on the left. It was so quiet that all I could hear as I moved was the creaking of my leathers. The door didn't have a bell, knocker, or even a number. Using my knuckles against the heavy wood, I stood off to the side, my right hand back on the pistol grip, thumb easing off the safety catch. I hated this bit. It wasn't as if I was expecting trouble. It was highly unlikely to happen here, given all the security I'd had to pass. But still I hated knocking on doors and not knowing who or what was on the other side. Footsteps echoed on a hard floor and locks were undone. The door started to open, only to be stopped by a security chain. A face, or rather half a face, moved into the 3 or 4 inch gap. It was enough for me to recognize its owner at once. I was pleasantly surprised. It would be much friendlier dealing with her than some squarehead. Looking almost innocent, Val's slapper from Helsinki was showing me just one very light blue eye and some dark blonde hair. It probably got lighter in the summer when the sun got to work on it. The only other thing I could see through the gap was her dark blue woolen polo neck. She looked at me without any expression, waiting for me to speak. "My name is Nick. You have something for me?"
"Yes. I've been expecting you."
She didn't bat an eyelid.
"Have you a cell phone or pager with you?"
I nodded. "Yeah, I've got a phone." Fuck what Valentin had said. I needed one with me for when a clinic called later.
"Could I ask you to turn it off, please?"
"It is." It was pointless wasting the battery while sitting on a bike. Tilting the helmet slightly so the pistol wouldn't fall out, I reached into my right-hand pocket and pulled out the phone, showing her the display. She gave a very courteous,
"Thank you."
Then the door closed, and I heard the chain being undone. The door reopened fully, but instead of standing there and ushering me in, she turned and started to walk back into the flat.
"Close the door behind you, would you please, Nick?"
As I stepped over the threshold, I smelled floor wax. I followed her down the corridor, taking in the apartment's layout. A couple of doors led off either side, and one at the far end was partly open. The floor was plain, light wood, the walls and doors gleaming white. There was no furniture or pictures, not even a coat hook. I switched my attention to Val's slapper. I thought it was her high heels that had made her look so tall in Finland, but I could see now that her legs did that all on their own. She was maybe just over 6 feet tall in her square-toed cowboy boots, which made a slow, rhythmic clack as her heels hit the floor. She walked like a supermodel on a catwalk. Her legs were sheathed in a pair of Armani jeans, the logo on the back pockets moving up and down in time with her heels. I couldn't keep my eyes off it. Slipping the pistol into my right-hand pocket, I moved the phone into my left, all the time looking at her and thinking that Armani should be paying her for this. I was almost tempted to buy myself a pair. One door to the right was partly open, and I glanced through. The kitchen was just as sterile as the corridor. Stark, white stools at a breakfast bar. No kettle, no letters on the side. Nobody lived here. I walked into the living room where she now stood. A large, white space with 3 unmatching dining room chairs at its center. Muslin curtains covered the windows, making the light dull and hazy. The only other objects in the room were 4 very large Harvey Nichols bags, which looked as if they were about to split at the seams, and a black Waterstones bag, the telltale shapes of books pushing at its sides. I moved to the far corner of the room and leaned against the wall. Through the double glazing of the large picture windows I could hear the faint murmur of traffic. She bent over one of the shopping bags and pulled out a buff A2-sized envelope.
"My name is Liv. Valentin sends his regards," she said as she brought it over to me. "And, of course, his gratitude. This is for you. $100,000.
Wonderful. That was the slate clean at the clinic, and another 4 months' treatment in the bank. She extended a perfectly manicured hand that showed she was no longer a teenager. The skin on her face was crystal clear and had no need of makeup. I reckon she was in her early 30s. Her hair was shoulder length, parted over her left eye and tucked back behind her ear. If she was wearing nail polish today, it was clear. She wore no rings, no bracelets, earrings or necklaces. The only jewelry I could see was a discreet gold tank watch with a black leather strap. But then She needed adorning like the Venus de Milo needed a velvet choker and diamond tiara. I was beginning to see why Val might prefer Finland to Russia. I wasn't going to open the envelope there and then. I didn't want to look desperate and untrusting. I was both, but I didn't want her to know that. I hadn't had the time to take much notice of her before. The first time I was aware of her was the day that Val arrived in Finland, 3 days before the lift. Reckies are about planning, not admiring the view. But I did now. I'd never seen a woman with such a perfectly symmetrical face, a strong jaw, full lips and eyes that felt as if they knew everything but revealed nothing. Her statuesque body looked like it had been shaped by canoeing or rock climbing rather than jumping up and down to music in a gym. The feel of the bundles in the envelope, even through the bubble wrap lining, brought me back to the real world. I put my helmet at my feet, unzipped my jacket, and slipped the envelope inside. She turned and went to sit on one of the chairs beside her purchases. I took up my position against the wall. She invited me to take one of the seats with a wave of her hand, but I declined, preferring to stand and be able to react if Liv had a few of her square-headed friends around, and this encounter turned out to be not entirely friendly. I was starting to get jealous of Val. Money and power always attract beautiful women. My pedal bin full of red reminders never had quite the same effect. Liv sat there looking at me in the way that Mr. Spock did on the bridge of the USS Enterprise when he thought things were illogical. It was the same look she'd given me at the hotel, penetrating and searching, as if she was staring right into my head, but somehow managing to give nothing back. It made me uncomfortable, and I stooped to pick up my helmet before leaving. She sat back and crossed her long legs.
"Nick, I have a proposition for you. From Valentin."
I left the helmet where it was, but said nothing. I'd learned the hard way that it's worth remembering we have two ears and just one mouth. Her gaze remained cool.
"Are you interested?"
I certainly was. "In principle." I didn't want to spend all day beating about the bush, and she didn't look or sound like the sort of person who'd do that anyway. So, let's just get on with it. "What does he want from me?"
"It's a simple task, but one that needs to be handled delicately. He needs someone, and he wants it to be you, to assist another person to enter a house in Finland. The other person is a cryptographer, a highly skilled hacker, if you like. Inside the house are computers, which this other person will use his skills to access and then download the contents onto a laptop for removal. The contents, before you ask, are merely some competitive intelligence which Valentin is keen to have in his possession."
She uncrossed her legs and pulled open one of her bags. "You mean industrial espionage?"
"That's not entirely correct, Nick. More commercial than industrial. Valentin is asking you to assist in the procurement of this data, but without the house owners knowing that you have done so. We want them to think they are the only ones with this information."
"It's as straightforward as that."
"There are some minor complications, which we will discuss if you are interested."
I was, but minor complications don't exist. They always turn out to be major. "How much?" I had to wait for an answer while she fished a cream-coloured cashmere cardigan out of the Harvey Nichols bag with a rustle of tissue paper. Sitting back in the chair, she laid it across her thighs, tucked her hair behind her ear again and looked directly at me.
"Valentin is offering you $1.7 million. If you are successful, of course."
She put up a hand.
"Non-negotiable. That is his offer. More than £1 million. He wanted you to have a round figure in your own currency. You're a lucky man, Nick. He likes you.
So far it sounded like a dream come true. That alone made me feel suspicious, but fuck it. We were just at the talking stage. Valentin is powerful enough just to take what he wants by force. Why does he need me? She expertly removed the tags from the cardigan, dropping them back into the bag. This is a job that requires finesse, not muscle. As I said, no one must know that Valentin has this material. In any event, he would prefer this was accomplished outside his normal channels. It's a delicate matter, and it was obvious in Helsinki that you have a certain skill in this area. That was all very nice, but it was question time. What exactly is it I'm trying to lay my hands on? She put on the cardigan, her eyes not leaving mine. Still measuring me up, I was sure of it. That, Nick, you don't need to know. We just need to be there before the Malaskaya. I had to cut in. You mean steal it before the Malaskaya? She smiled. Not steal. Copy. Download it. Your task is to get our man in and out without anyone knowing it has happened. Those are the terms, if you wish me to continue. I get it, I said. Malaskaya must be Russian for minor complications. She smiled again, her lips parting slightly to show perfect white teeth. The West call us the Russian Mafia, or simply ROC. As if we were one big group. We're not. We are many groups. The Malaskaya are one faction, and Valentin's only real competitor. Whatever you may think about him, he is a man with vision. The Malaskaya are not. They are just gangsters. It is very important that they never have access to this information. It would be a disaster for all of us. West as well as East. That is all I am prepared to say on the matter. Now, do you wish me to continue? Of course I did. It's always good to know something about who you're racing against. Not that she told me anything Val hadn't. I listened intently as she explained that the target house was still in the process of being prepared to use the competitive intelligence Val wanted. It wouldn't be online for another 6 or 7 days, and only then would I be able to get their man in to copy whatever it was. The problem was that once it was online, the Malaskaya were likely to trace its location very quickly. That's the race, Nick. I emphasize again. We must get it first, and no one must know that we've got it. It sounded okay to me. I'd spent years doing this kind of thing for far less than $1.7 million. Maybe this was my chance to sort out my life, and Kelly's, once and for all. One big fuck-off finger to everyone, especially Lynn. The meeting with him had really pissed me off. He knew the reason I'd been spared and he hadn't, was that I was more useful to the firm as an operator on the ground, whereas Lynn was just another pen pusher. And ever since Washington, the firm knew they had me by the bollocks. And I hated it when people had me by the bollocks. I'm concerned about going back to Finland, I said. I don't think I'm very popular there. She smiled patiently. They aren't looking for you, Nick. As far as the Finnish police are concerned, it was a purely Russian event. Valentin has already made a statement to that effect to the authorities. Don't worry. It's not an issue. If it was, Valentin wouldn't have risked offering you this task. She gave me time to consider what she had said as she picked fluff off her new cardigan. They weren't your friends, I hope. She looked up. Perhaps the choice of team was not one of your best decisions. I smiled and shrugged. I had no defense. I thought not. She twisted her forefinger and thumb to release the fluff onto the floor. For the next few minutes, I asked questions and she failed to give adequate answers. The objective, she said, was simple enough, but it didn't sound low risk to me. There were far too many questions left unanswered. How many people were in the house? What defences did they have? Where the fuck was it? I wasn't even allowed to know who I was taking in. I would find out only when I signed on the dotted line. On the other hand, $1.7 million versus £290 a day wasn't the kind of discrepancy I could afford to live with. She held out a piece of folded paper. I walked the 5 paces and took it. These are the contact details of the man you will be taking with you, assuming you can persuade him. If you can, the fee goes up to $2 million to cover his cut. Now, one other minor complication. Neither Valentin nor I can risk being associated with this task, so you will be the contact point. It's up to you to convince him to do it. I turned back to my helmet, reading an address and phone number in Notting Hill. Liv said, "His name is Tom Mancini. I believe you know him." I turned to face her. The name did ring a bell, but that didn't concern me. What did was that she knew about me, that she knew things about my past. My concern must have been plain to see. She smiled again and shook her head very slightly. "Naturally, Valentin has gone to the trouble of learning a lot about you these last few days. Do you think he would employ someone for such a task otherwise?"
"What does he know?"
"Enough, I'm sure. Also, enough about Tom. Valentin is sure you are both the right people for this. Now, Nick, as you will appreciate, there is little time. You need to be in Helsinki by Sunday. All I will require are your travel details. Everything else will be looked after."
She gave me the contact details. They were very basic, if not a bit over the top, but easy to understand, which was good, because my head was spinning around with 1.7 million other things at the time. She stood up. Our meeting was obviously over.
"Thank you for coming, Nick."
I shook her hand, which felt warm and firm. I looked her in the eye, probably for a fraction of a second too long, then bent to pick up my helmet. She followed me to the front door. As I reached for the handle, she said,
"One last thing, Nick."
I turned to face her. She was so close I could smell her perfume.
"Please do not turn your cell phone on until you are far away from here. Goodbye, Nick."
I nodded and the door closed. I heard the locks and chain being put back into position. Going down in the lift, I resisted the urge to dance a jig or jump up and click my heels. I'd never been one to embrace good fortune blindly. I'd never had that much of it to embrace, really. But Valentin's proposition sounded rather good. And what few doubts I had were dispelled by the A2 envelope inside my jacket, as long as it didn't go bang on the way home. The lift slowed, and the doors opened on the ground floor. The concierge was frowning at me as he tried to work out why I'd been up there so long. I pulled the ski mask from under my helmet and nodded to him. "She was wonderful," I said. By the time the sliding doors opened and I was facing the security cameras, the mask was over my head again. Chapter 11. Walking up the driveway, I started to pull out the chin strap on both sides of the helmet with my thumbs and forefingers. I just got past the gate and onto the pavement when I heard the noise of an approaching car. As I played with the straps, I looked up and to the left to check it was okay to cross. A Peugeot 206 was screaming towards me at the speed of sound. It was dark maroon and dirty from the last couple of weeks of slush and road salt. Behind the wheel was a white, knuckled woman in her early 30s with a chin-length bob. I waited for her to pass,
but as soon as she was about 10 meters away, she slowed to a more controlled pace. I checked to my right. The Israeli security guy about 70 meters away wasn't fussed about it, nor the uniformed officer who was looking very bored and cold on the opposite side of the road. I watched her get down to the barrier, indicating left, then join the stream of traffic. I pinged the number plate. It was an R-edge, but there was something else that was much more interesting. No sticker on the back window, telling me how wonderful the dealership was. I suddenly felt I knew what she was about. Just as quickly, I threw the idea aside. Shit. I was getting as paranoid about surveillance as Val and Liv were about mobile phones. Pulling my helmet on, I put the key into the Ducati's ignition, and was just starting to put my gloves on when I pinged another vehicle about 40 or 50 meters further up the road. A midnight blue Golf GTI in a line of vehicles, two up, both sitting back in their seats with no conversation or movement. The side windows were steamed up, but the windscreen had a direct view of the gates to the flats. I took a mental note of their reg. Not that it mattered. Well, that was what I'd tried to tell myself anyway. P116-something. That was all I needed to know. I decided that if I didn't stop being paranoid, I'd end up in the clinic with Kelly and began to give myself a mental slapping. Then I remembered. Paranoia keeps people like me alive. I had one more look around. My helmet down as if I was checking over the machine. I couldn't see anything else that made me feel uneasy, so I straddled the bike and pushed it off its stand. Turning the engine over, I pushed down the gear selector with my left foot, got into first, revved it up a little, turned left and made my way down towards the main gates. If the Golf was a trigger, the team that was about to follow me would have just received a point-by-point, stage-by-stage description of exactly what I was doing over the net. They needed a visual picture of what I looked like, what the bike looked like, its registration and what I was doing. That's helmet on, that's gloves on, not aware. Now complete, on the bike. Keys turned, engine on, stand by, stand by. Mobile towards Kensington, exits, approaching, no intention, no indicators on to show which way the vehicle is going. Everybody had to know exactly what I was doing and where I was to the nearest 10 meters, so they could put good covert surveillance on me. It's not like Miami Vice, where the good guys are sitting there with hand mics at their mouths and a big antenna stuck on the roof. All the antennas on E4 vehicles are internal, and you never see any mics. All you've got to do is hit a pressel, a little switch placed wherever you want. My preference had always been to have it fixed internally in the gear shift. That way you can just talk, making it look as if you're having fun or having a row. It doesn't really matter, as long as you're giving the details. Which, if I was getting triggered away from here, these two would now be doing. What made me still feel edgy was that the two cars were ideal for city surveillance. Both were very common models in dark, nondescript colours, and they were compact, so they could zip in and out of traffic and were easy to park up or even abandon if the targets went foxtrot, on foot. Not all cars have the retailer's sticker in the back window. It's just that surveillance cars would tend not to have them because they could become a VDM, visual distinguishing mark. If they were a surveillance team, they would have to be E4. The government's surveillance group that keeps tabs on everybody from terrorists to dodgy politicians in the UK. No one else would be able to stake out anything along this road. There was more security here than at Wormwood Scrubs. But why me? It didn't make sense. All I'd done was go into an apartment block. I got to the barrier and the guard looked out of his shed and into the cold, trying to work out if I was that bloke who said he was the courier half an hour ago. I turned right and merged with the traffic, which was still a nightmare. I headed the opposite way from the Peugeot and tried to be as casual as possible. I wasn't going to scoot away like a scalded cat and show that I was aware, but check to see if I was a target. It was starting to get dark now as I checked my mirror, expecting a surveillance bike to be up my arse in no time at all. Either the Peugeot driver was a loony and couldn't drive the thing, or she was a new or very useless member of E4. Val would have fitted very nicely into their portfolio, as would quite a few of the residents in this area. I could just be a new face that needed a picture for the surveillance log and general build-up of intelligence on the building. If I was right, she was trying to make a photo or video run on me, and had fucked up the timing. It's very hard to make these runs, as you only have one chance, and the pressure is always on. But this one was especially incompetent. The car could be rigged with both video and stills cameras, hidden behind the radiator grill or part of the headlight setup, or little bits of the bodywork cut out in the rear so there was just enough light for the lens. The cameras are activated electronically by the driver as they pass the target. The camera takes the whole reel of film at a very fast shutter speed. That's why the timing's so important. Hit the button too soon, and the film could be finished by the time you're on top of the target. Or the target might have walked behind a parked car as you begin your run, producing nothing more for your efforts than a nice picture of a Ford Fiesta, and a hard time from your bosses at the debriefing. The video camera is a much safer option. But all it takes on the move is a few bumpy seconds of the target walking. This time around, all they would have was a visual of a biker with a ski mask on. That made me feel a lot better. I had no idea where those pictures would turn up. But I knew Lynn wouldn't be in the best of moods if they found their way to him. I looked down at my mirror. Right on cue, I saw the reflection of a bike's headlight. It wasn't necessarily a surveillance operator, but I had ways of checking. I was riding like one of those 40-something sad bastards. The family are all grown up, the house is virtually paid for, so now they want the motorbike their mum would never let them have. It tends to be the biggest, fattest touring bike their platinum Amex card can handle, and they ride to and from work without ever getting within spitting distance of a speed limit. Except I wasn't scared to open up the throttle. I wanted to see if the single light behind me would do the same. It didn't. He shot past me at speed on an 8-year-old greasy Honda 500 with a battered old blue plastic box on the back held down by bungees. He was wearing well-used leathers and Wellington boots and turned to look at me through his visor, all beard and disgust. I knew just how he felt. There were other bikes behind me, weaving in and out of the traffic. I moved into the middle of the road and twisted the throttle to jump a couple of cars, then swung back into the stream, crawling along behind a rusting transit van. I let a few more bikes and mopeds pass me, and even a push bike, and after a couple more sets of lights it was obvious I had another weekend rider behind me, about two cars back. I turned left at the next junction, and he followed me. Looking for a natural stop, I pulled in at a newsagent's. Resting the bike on its side stand, I went through the charade of undoing my helmet and gloves as an M-Reg Yamaha VFR came past, probably waffling on the net, telling everybody where I was. "Stop, stop, stop! Charlie 1!" The bike. "Static on the left. At the newsagents. Bravo 1!" Me. "Still complete." On the bike. I took the helmet off but kept the mask on once he'd gone. Then got off the bike and walked into the shop. I couldn't just ride straight off again, because that would show I was aware. The young woman behind the counter looked alarmed because I hadn't taken my mask off. There was a sign politely asking me to do just that. If she'd asked, I would have told her no, in my tear-the-arse-out-of-it Cockney accent, and to fuck off because I was cold. I didn't want the team to come and requisition the security videotape with yours truly on it. She wasn't going to argue. Why should she care if I was there to steal the money? It could be dangerous for her. I went back to the bike, clutching a copy of the Evening Standard. If I was right, there'd probably be a bike at either end of the road by now. The nets would be in chaos as cars hit their horns at the dickhead drivers who had suddenly decided to throw up, turn 180, in the traffic, all out of sight to me, trying to get in position for the stakeout. A static, short-term target is always a dangerous time for a surveillance team. Everyone has to get in position so that next time the target goes mobile, they've covered every possible option. That way, the target moves to the team, instead of the team crowding the target. But where was the trigger? I couldn't be bothered to look. I'd find out soon enough. I pushed the Ducati down into first gear and carried on in the same direction I'd been heading before, towards South Kensington Tube Station, about half a mile away. Parking up in the bike row on the north side, I walked into the packed station, looking as though I was unbuckling my helmet, though I didn't. Instead, I walked straight through and crossed the road, still with my helmet on. The south side of the station had a large, busy and very confusing junction with a big triangular island housing a flower stall. Their propane gas heaters not only blasted out heat as I went by, but also a very comforting bright red light in the gathering darkness. I moved with a crowd of pedestrians to the far side of the junction, past a row of shops along the old Brompton Road. About 50 meters further along, I went into the pub on the corner, took off my helmet and mask, and settled on a bar stool just back from the window. The pub was packed with shoppers, wanting to get out of the cold, and office workers having a drink with friends. I saw the Gulf within minutes, but without the passenger. He or she was probably Foxtrot, scurrying around in the tube station looking for me. Then I saw the VFR, and its black, leather-clad rider. They would have found the Ducati now, and the whole team, maybe 4 cars and 2 bikes, would be bomb-bursting about, fighting the traffic, calling in the areas they'd covered so their control could try and direct them elsewhere in some kind of coherent pattern. I almost felt sorry for them. They'd lost their targets, and they were in the shit. I'd been there 1,000 times. Chapter 12. I sat and watched as the Gulf, with a dark-haired male at the wheel, came back round the one-way circuit and pulled in to pick up a short, brown-haired woman. They were off again before her door was even closed. They'd done all they could. Now it was a question of waiting to see if the target returned to his bike. It wouldn't have been a big deal to them when I became temporarily unsighted. This always happens for short periods, but the fact that it had happened at the tube station was a big problem for them. Once they'd failed to pick me up again, their next move would be to stake out the bike. Then some of the team would have checked out known target locations. There were only 2. One was the apartment block, and they would be checking with the porter which apartment I'd gone to for sure. The other was the address where the bike was registered, a P.O. box just a few shops down from where it was parked. It was an office supplier's, and instead of having a box number, I had a suite number, because I wanted to make it sound like an expensive apartment block. No doubt that was what the woman was checking out. Nick Davidson was the registered owner of the bike, and Suite 26 was where he supposedly lived. The real Davidson was going to be incredibly pissed off if he ever came back from Australia, because I'd taken over his life in the UK. He was going to get a hard time from customs, immigration and special branch if he ever stepped off a plane now that this had happened. He'd be listed. It also meant that having Nick Davidson as my safety blanket cover ID was now history, and that pissed me off. It had taken painstaking months to get a national insurance number, passport, bank account, all the things that bring a character to life. And now I had to bin him. Worse still, I'd have to bin the bike. There'd certainly be a trigger on it for the next few hours, depending on how important they thought I was. An electronic device might even be attached to it. The only thing that cheered me up was the thought of what would happen to the person who'd eventually steal it after seeing it standing there for a few days. They wouldn't know what had hit them when the E4 team closed in. I'd nursed a Coke while keeping dog through the large Victorian windows. My glass was nearly empty, and if I didn't want to look out of place, I'd need to get a refill. Fighting my way to the bar, I ordered a pint of orange and lemonade and went and sat in the corner. No need to look outside now. I knew a team were on me. I just had to sit it out, keeping my eyes on the doors in case they started to check out the pubs. In an hour's time, it would be the end of the working day. I'd wait until then and lose myself in the darkness and commuter traffic. As I sipped my drink, I thought about Tom Mancini. His name was certainly familiar. One of my first jobs as a K in 93 had been to drive him from North Yorkshire, where he worked, down to a Royal Navy facility near Gosport, Hampshire. I was told to grip him so much that he'd beg to be handed over to the firm's people, who I was delivering him to. It didn't take that much. Just a few slaps, a scary face, and me telling him that if he fucked me about, the only thing left ticking on his body would be his watch. Once we'd got him down in one of the forts built along the coast, he wasn't even given time to clean himself up before the firm's interrogation team explained the facts of life. A technician at Menwith Hill listening station, he'd been detected trying to obtain classified information. I wasn't allowed in on the interrogation, but I knew they told him Special Branch would be arresting him the next day for offences against the Official Secrets Act. They couldn't stop that. However, if he didn't get smart, that would be just the start of his problems. He would shut up in court about what he'd really been tampering with. Whatever that was, it seemed the firm didn't want anyone to know about it, even Special Branch, for the charge would be for a lesser offence. He would tell them who he was getting the information for, and, of course, he'd have no recollection of this meeting ever taking place. He'd serve a short sentence, and that would be the end of it. If he ever uttered a word to anyone about the deal, however, someone like me would come and pay him a visit. Tom had been fucking about with the big boys. I knew that RAF Menwith Hill, on the moors near Harrogate in Yorkshire, was one of the largest intelligence-gathering stations on Earth. Its massive, golf-ball-shaped radomes monitored Europe's and Russia's airwaves. It might be a British base, but in reality it was a little piece of the USA on British soil, run by their all-powerful NSA, National Security Agency. It was manned by about 1,400 American engineers, physicists, mathematicians, linguists, and computer scientists. The staff was complemented by 300 Brits, which meant that there were as many people working at Menwith Hill as there were for the firm. Menwith Hill operated in close tandem with GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters at Cheltenham, gathering electronic information from as far afield as Eastern Russia. GCHQ did not, however, have automatic access to the intelligence gathered at Menwith Hill. All information went directly to the NSA at Fort Meade in Maryland. From there, information collected on terrorism that might, for example, affect the UK, was redistributed to the Security Service, Special Branch, or Scotland Yard. Britain's contract with the US is that we can only buy American nuclear weapons on the condition that bases like Menwith are allowed to operate on British soil, and that the US has access to all British intelligence operations. Sad but true. They are Big Brother. Britain is just one of the little runt siblings. From what I could remember, Tom was all mouth and trousers. He came on like a jack-the-lad Cockney trader, which was rather strange, because he came from Milton Keynes and was about as boring as his postcode. By the end of the drive south, however, he had been like a small child, curled up on the back seat. It worried me that Val knew I had met Tom, that he had access to details about a 24-hour period of my life that I'd all but forgotten about, but I was in it for the money, nothing else, and so I cut that thought away, just in case it made me change my mind. I finished my drink, picked up my helmet and headed for the toilets. Placing the helmet on the cistern in a cubicle, I sat down on the lid, unzipped my jacket, and pulled out the envelope. After an afternoon of people missing the pan and flicking dog ends in the urinals, the place stank. I inspected the nylon fibre type, bubble wrap envelope. Then, resting it on my knees and using both hands, I pressed down and started to run my palms over it, fingertips moving up and down the contours of the contents. I turned it over and checked the other side. I couldn't feel any sort of wiring, or anything more solid than what I hoped were the notes, but then again, that didn't mean a thing. A wafer-thin battery from a Polaroid film tucked between the bundles would kick out enough power to initiate a letter bomb. It might be Val's special little way of saying thank you. I picked it up and put the fold to my nose. If it was a device, and they'd used any exotic or older-style explosives, I might be able to smell them. Sometimes it's marzipan, sometimes linseed oil. I was expecting something more sophisticated, but these things have to be tested for. All I could smell was the urinals. The bar noise rose and fell as the outer door opened and closed. I carried on inspecting the envelope. I decided to go ahead and open it. It felt like money, weighed like money. If I was wrong, the whole pub would know about it soon, and a pissed-off insurance company would be shelling out for a refit. I opened the knife blade of my Leatherman and gently cut down the centre of the envelope, checking inside every centimetre or so for wires. It was looking promising. I started to see green US banknotes. Each bundle of used $100 bills that I carefully pulled out was banded, and told me the bundle contained $10,000. There were 10 of them. I was a very happy Teddy indeed. Val had put his money where his mouth was. I didn't just respect him now, I liked the man. Not enough to introduce him to my sister yet, but then again, I didn't have a sister. Someone else entered and tried the toilet door. I grunted, making it sound like I was having a big boy dump. He checked the next one, and I heard the sound of jeans coming down and him getting on with the business. I smiled as I started to stuff the money into my leathers, feeling quite pleased with myself, as my next-door neighbour farted for England. Staying in the pub for another half hour, drinking more orange and lemonade and reading the Standard for the third time. I wondered if the team had been called off yet. 9 out of 10 times it boils down to money. They were probably hoping to earn a little Christmas bonus out of me. E4 operators get treated as badly as nurses. They work their bollocks off and are expected to carry on regardless. By now they'd know the address was a P.O. box arrangement, and that would have set their alarm bells ringing. They'd probably plan to go into the office tomorrow, open up my box and see what was in there. They'd even put me on their own special mailing list, as post addressed to Suite 26 came through the Royal Mail's sorting system, it would be sidetracked for a while so that prying eyes could have a little look-see. All they would find was my access bill. Well, Davidson's bill. Perhaps they'd be nice enough to pay it. I certainly wouldn't bother any more. By tomorrow, if they decided to dig deeper, they'd also know that Mr. Davidson had been to Norway recently, returning by the same route he'd travelled all those weeks ago. What would they make of that? I doubted that their conclusion would be a skiing trip after Davidson had been seen coming out of the targeted apartment block where one of the owners was a Russian who'd got hit just days ago, in a country a mere day trip away from where Davidson had disembarked. Fuck it. It was too late to worry about all that now. As long as they didn't have a photograph of me, I'd be okay. I sat there with another Coke and a packet of Ready Salted. 35 minutes on, I finally decided to make a move. The rush hour traffic on all sides of the triangle was moving at about a metre a minute. A confusion of headlights and exhaust fumes. Every fourth car had its indicator lights flashing, thinking the other lane was quicker. The pedestrian traffic too was much heavier and moved quicker than the vehicles. Everybody was huddled over, fighting the cold and just wanting to get home. Leaving the helmet under the table, I exited through a door that led out onto a different road. The motorbike helmet was a BDM. So were my leathers, but I could hardly discard them. All I could do was cut down on the things that would trigger me. The priority was to get a hotel for the night before I contacted Tom in the morning. I also needed clothing. Without a bike, there was no way I could walk around looking like Judge Dredd. If you want late-night shops, it has to be the West End. I grabbed a taxi to Piccadilly Circus and changed $1,000 at various bureaux de change, throwing in a couple of hundred at a time. The shopping frenzy was another short cab ride away, in Selfridges, where I bought clothes, washing and shaving kit, and a nice little hold-all for my new-found wealth. Then I booked myself into the Selfridges Hotel, using my Nick Stone credit card. To have used Davidson's would have invited a knock on the door within hours. After a bath and a change of clothes, all very predictable, jeans, Timberland boots, blue sweatshirt and a dark blue nylon puffer jacket, I called room service for a club sandwich and coffee. Chapter 13. Saturday, 11th of December, 1999. I woke up and looked at Baby G. It was just after 8, time for a quick couple of laps round the bath before getting dressed. Looking like a kid in his shiny new Christmas Day clothes, I left the jacket with my leathers and went down to breakfast, taking the money bag with me. There was $25,000 left after a very grateful clinic had received not only what was owing to them, but also a wedge on account. It's strange how finance directors will come in of an evening to collect a payment, even brew coffee and pour it. The newspapers were full of doom and gloom. And as I downed my full English, listening to the Americans or Israelis talking about the shopping they were going to be doing before they went back home, I felt good about fulfilling my responsibilities to Kelly, even though I knew I should be doing a lot more than just paying out money. Back in my room, I settled on the bed and called the number on the paper that Liv had given me. A young woman answered. Her hello sounded as friendly as if I was the fourth wrong number in a row. "Oh, hi. Is Tom there?" "Nah, he's not," she snapped. "It'll be in coins. Who are you?" It sounded as if all was not well in the Mancini household. "Just a friend. Coins, did you say?"
"Yes."
"What is that, a shop, or..."
"It's the calf off Ledbury Road."
I was obviously stupid for not knowing. "Thanks a..." The phone slammed down. Talking Pages told me that Coins was in Talbot Road, Notting Hill. I put my squeakily clean blue duvet jacket on, picked up my swag bag and jumped into a taxi to join Tom for a brew, borrowing a read of the cabbie's A to Z on the way to work out exactly where he lived. The sky might be full of dark clouds, but I was still feeling good. I didn't know Notting Hill at all, just that it had a carnival each year, and that there'd been a bit of a frenzy about Julia Roberts coming to stay. During the film's hype, I'd read all this stuff in the papers about the village atmosphere and how wonderful it was to live there. I didn't see much evidence of a village. Just expensive clothes shops. The sort with one pair of shoes in the window surrounded by spotlights, a few antique shops and an Oxfam store. We turned corners and drove past stucco-fronted houses, mostly cut up into flats and very run down, with chunks of plaster falling off the brickwork. The cab stopped at a crossroads, and the dividing window opened.
"It's a one-way, mate. I'll drop you off here, if that's all right. It's just down there on the left."
I could see the large awning sticking out over the pavement, with plastic side panels keeping the elements off the brave ones who wanted to sip their cappuccinos outside. I paid him and took a walk. Coins turned out to be double-fronted, with a few empty tables outside. The large windows on each side of the door were steamed up from cooking and people. As I went in, it was obvious from the rough wooden floors and plain laminated plywood that the cafe was trying to look down to earth and no nonsense. The kitchen was open plan, and the smells were very tempting, even with half a kilo of bacon and eggs still weighing me down. There was no sign of Tom, so I took a seat in the far corner. There were magazines lying around on the tabletops, designer pictures on the walls and flyers for a shitload of artistic events. The menu was a sheet of A4 paper and a plastic folder, offering everything from neat cholesterol to vegetarian sausages and salads. The prices certainly didn't match the decor. Someone was making a down-to-earth, no-nonsense fortune. The clientele seemed to average late 20s, early 30s, trying so hard to look individual that they all looked like clones. Everyone was in baggy cargo trousers and sleeveless puffers, and must have taken ages to get their hair looking like they'd just got out of bed. Quite a few were wearing thick, framed rectangular glasses, more to be seen in than to see through.
Hi, sweetie. What can I get you?
An American female voice floated down to me as I studied the menu. Glancing up, I asked for a latte and toast.
Sure, sweetie.
She turned and presented the world's second most perfect rear, covered in tight black nylon flares. As she walked away, I couldn't help staring at it, and was pleased to catch others doing the same. She must bring in a lot of custom. No wonder Tom came here. There was nothing else to do but sit and listen to other people's conversations. It seems that everybody was either just about to get a movie or just about to be in a play. But it just hadn't quite happened yet, and everybody had a fantastic script that was being read by a marvellous man who used to share a flat with Anthony Minghella. The only time people stopped talking was when their mobiles rang, only to talk even louder than before. Jambo, dude, how's it going, man? Rear of the Year came back.
Here you are, sweetie.
She gave me my glass of latte, which burned my fingers as I watched her walk back to the kitchen. I picked up a copy of The Guardian, which a girl sitting on the table next to mine handed over as she left. We smiled at each other, knowing we were both thinking the same thing about our American friend. Looking down at the front page, I waited for my toast and Tom. Half an hour later, the toast was finished, and I was on my second latte. Clones came and went, air-kissing as they met, and being very important with each other. Then, at last, Tom entered. At least, I thought he was Tom. His greasy hair was now ponytailed just past his shoulders, making him look like a member of a Los Angeles garage band. His cheeks were more hamster-like than I remembered. Maybe the extra pounds he'd put on had changed the contours of his face. The clothes looked as if they'd come from the same shop as everyone else's here. Canvas daps, brown cargos and a faded green sweatshirt, with a t-shirt that had started off white. Then gone a few rounds with something blue. He must have been freezing. Settling his chubby arse on a tall stool along the breakfast bar facing the window, he pulled a magazine out from under his arm. Some kind of palm-top computer and Games Monthly. At least he looked the part.